Hey guys, this is Robert Breedlove from the What is Money Show. And as you've learned by watching this show, Bitcoin is the single most important asset you can own in the 21st century. And one of the most important companies in Bitcoin today is NYDIG. NYDIG's mission is to facilitate financial security for all. They accomplish this by bringing a high level of professionalization and sophistication to the Bitcoin marketplace. As a true game changer in the industry, NYDIG is safely unlocking the power of Bitcoin for forward-thinking individuals and institutions alike. By using NYDIG, you'll gain access to an end-to-end institutional-grade platform, providing Bitcoin OTC transactions, Bitcoin collateralized borrowing, secure custody, asset management, derivatives, financing, market research, and more. And all of these services meet the highest regulatory, governance, and audit standards. Led by Robbie Gutman, Yin Zhao, and Ross Stevens, NYDIG has absolutely exploded onto the Bitcoin scene recently and is leading the way for ongoing institutional adoption in this nascent asset class. So please be sure to check out NYDIG as a single source for all your Bitcoin needs.
Jeff and I had a little Twitter exchange with another guy between our recording sessions yesterday. And this sort of dovetails from our discussion on day one, where we're saying that it seems that the economy could be headed in. We're in choppy waters, let's say. We're in very deeply uncharted territory in this fiat currency experiment. And it seems like there's a systemic transition underway. We are transitioning from a legacy failing system that is in many ways trying to fight the laws of nature. It's fighting technological innovation and price deflation, running up against a world that's innovating faster than ever, just exponentially more faster in the digital age. So we saw this deflationary shock in March 2020, and the general discussion point was, could that happen again? What does that look like if it does? Correct positioning, directionally at least, and where do we go from there? What happens in the aftermath of an event like that? So, welcome back, Jeff. Would love to maybe just dive into that topic, and then we can flip back to our longer arc.
Oh, sure. And it's probably you. I think you summed it up really well there. We're in a phase transition between systems, and so. And in that phase transition, there's going to be, people are so focused on the micro, the day to day, and they're watching what's happening day to day that they're missing the big picture of what's happening. And so what I would expect is a whole bunch of flailing from the existing system as it unwinds. And that's not going to be a straight line. And I can't tell you what happens today, tomorrow, or anything else, but I can tell, we can get some hints. And we talked about a couple of those yesterday, but if you think about today, if inflation is, so today the news is inflation is moving higher. Jobs report was better. 10-year yield is going up and everything else. And if inflation is moving higher, then the bond market is going to demand higher rates because they're losing money. And those rates will go way higher to try to offset that inflation. Mm-hmm. But if the rates go higher, the entire economy collapses. No business could handle those. Very few businesses could handle those rates, and it changes the economic value of stocks, housing, everything else, and the governments themselves. It changes. You're so offside right now that those rate changes change the structure. The governments go broke. Mm-hmm. So as that happens, and now you have hedge funds front running that happening, right? They know the bigger game. Everybody understands how that's going to look. The small, the game within the game, you're going to have flows back and forth that kind of because if interest rates go up, the economy collapses. you know interest rates can't go up. So the Fed is going to have to suppress the yield curve and bring down rates. Now, yesterday, Powell says they're going to let the market decide. Yeah, good luck. Right. Yeah. And so, because if the market decides against this inflation rate, the true rate of what market rates would demand are so much higher than people even could imagine to protect against that inflation.
Right.
So there's no way the market's going to decide. They're going to have, because if the market decides, the entire economy collapses and we see what's there been there all along.
Right.
It's just a house of cards. And so I think even this conversation, it could happen after the series comes out, before it could happen. And it has a whole bunch of different implications for what that looks like. I'd say to the people that are watching this, expect choppiness, personally, if that happens and it's a sell-off, like you said, in March, of Bitcoin and everything else, that becomes a really great buying opportunity for Bitcoin.
Yeah, definitely. And we are today, this is March 5th, 2021. Interestingly enough, about almost exactly 1 year after the last collapse, which I think was the liquidity crisis, which was March 12th, I believe, last year. So if I can maybe assimilate that, it's as if the U.S. Treasury, the 10-year U.S. Treasury, the yield on that serves as roughly an inflation expectation proxy, right? So as yields go up, that means there's more expected inflation, essentially. And bonds are inverse. So as yields go up, that means prices go down. And those rates underpin the cost of capital, right? So that's the cost of capital that washes across the entire economy. And given that the current capital structure in most of the world is debt, it's very heavily indebted. Our number is 350% global debt to GDP. Higher rates are crushing to the economy. So exactly. Central banks will basically, if they say they're gonna let the market decide, you and I know, based on what the market would do, that a natural interest rate would be much higher than the artificial interest rate, because the way to think about this maybe is that the interest rate's the price of money. Money is insuring market actors against uncertainty, and we are in the most uncertain economy perhaps in all history. So the natural interest rate is much higher than the nominal interest rate.
Exactly. And so what would the stock market look like in that event if the market actually decided?
Mm-hmm.
It would wipe out everything. It would be a 90% collapse. It would look like the Great Depression. It would be, if the market decided today on rates, that's what it would, it would keep on deciding.
And that's
actually why I think everybody knows that there's going to be further yield curve control.
Yes.
It's going to be a forcing function and the Fed is going to come back in.
Yes.
And not just the Fed, central banks all over the world are going to come back in. So it's a game of chicken. But that game of chicken has almost exact opposite effects on your portfolio.
Right.
So if you're heavy in stocks and that game of chicken and the Fed says, okay, we're going to let this go for a while, stocks are going to get crushed. So are all other asset classes, and having cash in that environment is a good thing.
Yes.
If on the opposite side of that, having cash in an environment where there's massive printing and yield curve control and everything else, your cash is getting wiped out.
Right. And this is all what we're talking about here, and something we'll get into much more deeply later on, is it's error correction, right? We've been accumulating errors by suppressing the interest rate effectively for 50 plus years now. And you cannot avoid the inevitable correction. Like the market.
You're essentially centrally planning an economy.
Yes.
With very few people making decisions.
Yeah.
And the economy and there's no, history proves you can't do that.
Right. And so the error rate or the error magnitude swells the longer that central planning is carried out, and it has to be corrected at some point.
Building on that, if you just take this back 20 years, what would have happened in a natural course as technology was deflating things? Rates would have gone way up.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you would have had a clearing of the, excesses of the system.
Right.
And it would have stayed more stable than it is. Instead, you kept on suppressing interest rates and thinking that you're dealing in a different world, and I can grow my way out of it by suppressing interest rates.
Right.
And so you started suppressing, so 20 years ago, 25, you're suppressing interest rates more and more and more so. And every, if you want one thing you could guarantee, look at the Congressional Budget Office for projections of growth after an interest rate decline. It's the one thing you could, if you wanted to short their projections, you could make a lot of money.
Right. Yeah, it speaks to the ineptitude of central planning. And then I guess the last point here that's really important is that when this, I would say that the March 2020 liquidity crisis was a microcosm of what we're talking about could be the big event, right? There's going to be at some point this deflationary shock, a flight to safety where people are, you know, uncertainty has spiked, volatility has spiked, people are seeking shelter in dollars, treasuries, gold. In that event, all risk assets get crushed to the hardest, of which Bitcoin still lives far out on that risk spectrum today. And I remember during that event, people were calling me like, why isn't Bitcoin going up right now? Shouldn't Bitcoin be going up? It's like, that's not how it works. There's a flight to safety in these liquidity crises, but then the response to that liquidity crisis by the central bank, where they just pump in all this additional artificial liquidity, take reserve requirements down to zero, you know, all pedal to the metal, so to speak, from a central bank policy tool perspective. That's what creates the tailwinds for Bitcoin. And that's what we've seen, right? In addition to the halving schedule, which drives Bitcoin, you know, in our model, it's not really ahead of schedule on its price due to that event.
And at some point, it won't fall the same as it did last March, even in those events.
Right.
Because what's happening is people are starting to realize Bitcoin is actually the risk-free rate.
Yes.
It's the thing that is actually the most true market signal around, and it's open all the time.
Yes. The way I like to describe it is go ahead.
No, so, but over time, so even that won't have the same negative effect on Bitcoin. People know what's coming next.
Right. I describe it as the ultimate risk on asset competing to be the ultimate risk off asset.
That's a great way.
And the market cap tells you how far along it is in that journey. So
exactly.
Yeah. So
yeah.
That's good. I think that's really important. We talked about that because it's important for people to understand that. You know, these things are not instantaneous. It's not like the system blows up and Bitcoin goes straight up. There's a flight to the safest assets in the room. And then those assets, which, you know, largely dollars and treasuries, become more diluted. And that provides a tailwind for the growth in scarce assets.
Yeah. And then what ends up happening in that too, but because we live in an immediate world, right? We're on Twitter, everyone else, and then everybody says, I told you so. And it starts to reframe, but you're looking at a narrow point in time against a way bigger trend. So it's just important to constantly zoom out. Where are we in this? There's bound to be some fluctuations on the way through of a phase transition between currencies that were to where we're going. There's bound to be a lot of choppiness.
Absolutely. And I think that maybe that is the double, if we say the digital age as a double-edged sword or has a dark side, maybe that's kind of the dark side, is it does make us a little more short-term. It can pull us into more short-term thinking because there's just so much information coming out all the time. That's why, to your point, it's very important to always try to zoom out and see the broader changes going on. And to that end, you know, we kind of left off our longer arc discussion talking about digital platforms and how they've gained so much value in the marketplace by aggregating and standardizing customer access to supply, whether the supply is Amazon books or consumer attention in Facebook, whatever it may be. It's the digital infrastructure and companies let us pull supply in a way and at a lower cost than was ever even by orders of magnitude higher than is possible in the analog age in physical space, like say in a bookstore or a billboard or whatever it may be. And I guess the interesting one there was when we looked at Google, you make the point in the book that Google actually, what they're doing is they're extending the reach of sellers really, or advertisers, but they're doing this by giving customers the illusion of choice, which I thought was really interesting. You say that we search something on Google, we get a billion results, but no one ever goes past page one. Right. So Google's sort of really deciding what you buy, or the Google algorithm, I guess we could say, is deciding consumer behavior, or heavily influencing consumer behavior, not deciding necessarily. And I thought that was so interesting for me, because like that's the same tactic we use on our two-year-old. When we want her to do something, you know, put on your pants. And she's like, I don't want to put on my pants. Like, well, do you want your pink pants or your blue pants? And then she's like, okay, I guess I'll take the blue ones. So it's like backing them into to making this decision. It seems like that same, maybe a more sophisticated version of that, but the same type of psychological tactic is being used by a Google. Like, do you see it that way, or is it? Are they just
100%. So every product you use is designed in a different way today around getting you to use it. It's designed into the product. So from the little red button that shows up on your email or on your phone, it's impossible not to press that button. On the tweets on the side, you see how many new people you have and direct. It's so hard not to press it. It's designed into the way we understand the brain today, and the way it, imaging and everything else in the brain. You can essentially back end human behavior into a technology product.
Incredible.
I mean this because, I do it, hopefully for good. But literally, in product, that's what you're doing. A very big change from the way it used to work forget technology, the way you used to go to market to the way you go to market now is you used to go find buyers, and once you had enough buyers, you'd go find supply.
Right.
Now it's the opposite. Supply equals demand. So you aggregate supply. So the game in all these platforms is aggregating supply and getting the supply to do the work on your platform. And as they do more work on your platform, so the gamification of that design through game theory, through a whole bunch of how do they get more views and compete with each other as you're driving more and more supply, equals once you hit a tipping point on supply, it just keeps on getting better and better and better. And you're able to use artificial intelligence to be able to match better, predict which supply gets to see which person, and it becomes really valuable for us as users. A story your two-year-old, and this is before some of the brain imaging and where this is, one of behavior science, one of the top industry experts, years ago, I remember going to one of his conferences and I was spellbound for hours. See, as he went through this, he called it the pick-nuff process. And by pick-nuff, positive, immediate, certain, against, negative, uncertain future consequences. And so what he said, and they used examples to be able to do that. And so he said, take smoking. Why it's so hard to change that is, positive, you know what you get when you're small. It's immediate and it's certain. And the faster the immediacy, the more of a habit it creates in you. Against a negative, cancer or something like that, uncertain, I might die of cancer. Everybody knows their 80-year-old grandfather is some person who hasn't died of cancer, so that it's uncertain. And it's a future consequence. And when your picks outweigh your... it's impossible to change that behavior change. So you change behavior with picks that out-influence the existing picks, not the negative future. And I'm going to give you an example of what I did with this. But texting while driving, exactly the same challenge to society, because the immediacy, the positive, I get that text, I need to look at it. It's that little surprise. You don't need to look at it, but it's that little surprise in your brain. I have to. It's immediate and it's certain against negative. I might crash into somebody, uncertain in future. And so those things are in our society are really tough to change. And they're tough to change because they're human patterns that we drive into. And so those human patterns are exploited in technology products to be able to create habits. That's the way it looks like. I came back from this conference. My daughter was 4 years old and she hated piano. For us, piano was a must. And you had to learn piano. It was just a skill set we wanted our kids to learn. So, and we were treated the future, uncertain, everything else. And she hated it. My wife was constantly battling. She would battle. And I said, okay, let me try something. I got piano for the next week. Just not a word. I sat down with her, as you can imagine, four-year-old battling and everything else. I sat down with her piano bench and I said, show me what you learned this week. Bonk, bonk. And it was terrible. Like she didn't try because she was, and I said, wow, that's incredible. Positive. Yeah. Every time, and then I sat down with her again the next, and every time I just positive immediate certain and more, and then she sat down without me, and I ran in and holy cow, you're the practice. Her teacher said in that week, she said she learned more in a year than in that week, and she's glowing, and she comes home, and her piano, what she did in piano. Blew our minds in the next couple of years. Blew our minds because it was all about her doing it. And I unwound, and that example, I kind of unwound, okay, it's true everywhere. It's true in me. The things I'm good at are the things that somebody gave me positive reinforcement early in the path. And it might have just been because I was around a whole bunch of people that were really bad at it.
yeah, that's true.
and I wanted to do more, and it became practice, and I wanted to do more. So that's a small example, really small example of what's being built into every single technology product today, and it's just a very small example.
That's so interesting. The documentary that comes to mind is The Social Dilemma. I don't know if you've seen that one on Netflix yet.
And
they talk about all these. I guess there's psychophysiological cues where they're targeting the lower brainstem to trigger dopamine response, et cetera, to just get you to engage with the tech. They need you to look at their app more, you know, swipe, whatever gesture they need you to do to sell your attention to advertisers. They're purposely trying to solicit that.
Exactly. And some of the technology products are way worse than others. And Facebook is an example.
Yeah.
If you're using a free product, you're the product.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. So, and you're the product they're selling to advertisers. And that's not a bad thing. Or is, if you want that trade-off, that's part of the trade-off in using the free product. And others do that differently. So to me, Apple does a pretty good job of protecting your privacy. But it's actually the exact same thing. So Apple, my watch knows more about me than my doctor.
Right. Yeah.
It knows my sleep patterns. It knows my heart rate all the time. It knows a whole bunch of things. And if Apple asked me one day, say, hey, could you give us your genome? And I trust the privacy of their network. It would give me better outcomes.
Yeah.
And so all of those things, what we're talking about is a collection of data. Mm-hmm. To drive better decisions. Yes. And it's actually the same reason why you see monopolies form around that data.
Right.
Because what ends up happening as you do that work, your algorithm gets better and better at prediction on both sides of the supply network. Mm-hmm. So the artificial intelligence gets better and better and better, and it's a winner take all. Yeah. Nobody uses the second best algorithm.
Yeah.
And so that network, and then what we believe, when you go back to that illusion of choice, it's giving us better results. And so why would we trust something? Why would we waste our time on something that's giving us inferior results?
Right.
So we don't go to page 46 or 152 because of that. And maybe the best result for us is on page 146.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that analogy of data as digital oil, actually, because it's an energy network that, you know, even Rockefeller, when he started to compete in these markets, he had to standardize, first of all, aggregate and then standardize access to the supply. And he was just, it became same type of thing, a monopoly, because everyone needed this homogenous oil to energize their machines, but then the actual logistics of accessing it needed to be standardized. So there was an efficiency gain in doing that. It's kind of the same with an algorithm, right? Where it's like everyone's just going to use the best algorithm because it serves them best, and that feeds the growth of the monopoly. Do you think then that PicNuff model that you mentioned, it really sounds like that would be a force actually raising our time preference, which is to say making us think shorter term?
For sure. So, and that's what ends up happening. We get sucked into the attention void.
Yeah.
And when we just talked about it in a different context, but the zoom out, we don't get enough time to really think, because the technology is on us all the time. And we'll talk about it here, but we're going to talk about it a little later in a different section too. But we don't really know which ideas are ours in the first place.
Right.
And what we really believe, or what we believe because somebody else believes it near us and has influenced us in a decision. And now that is we brought that into our belief system. Mm-hmm. And so if you're constantly in that all the time, you have very little time to step back from the fray.
Yeah.
And see the bigger picture and everything.
And you're giving up your sovereignty in a lot of ways, right? Even if you maybe don't know it necessarily, but you've opened up a vector where this platform can incept ideas into you almost, right? They're delivering advertisements or whatever it may be. It reminds me of that quote, I don't know who said it, a lie can run around the world while the truth is still putting on its shoes.
Right.
If you just deliver something with so much immediacy and, you know, positive reinforcement, and you're blind to the longer term consequences, that it seems like it could feed really bad behavior. Like that would be the dark side to the digital age I'm alluding to here. Is it could just make us short term,
or us believing that the digitization and everything else saves us a whole bunch of time, and us getting consumed by the machine, wasting all our time on. So let's use Twitter as an example. And I enjoy Twitter and everything else, but I'm sensitive to that I'm not on Twitter all the time.
Yeah.
Because if I'm on Twitter all the time, am I really measuring my life? Like, am I there instead of going out skiing or doing things that I really enjoy with friends, family, and everything else? So you have to be careful, but it becomes super addictive, because as soon as you put up a post, you want to see who liked it.
Yes. Right.
Yeah. Belonging,
right?
Exactly. Am I belonging? Right. Yeah. And so it plays off these things, and being so deep in technology and understanding the psychology behind it as well, and the brain science behind it, I also understand my own interaction with it can step back from the fray to be able to understand the bigger picture.
I'll tell you what, even while I was watching The Social Dilemma, and you're really talking about stepping back from it, you're watching the documentary that's telling you what these things are doing to you, I still felt this little spark on my brainstem to want to check my Twitter like probably three times during the documentary.
Right. Right.
It's one thing you can observe it and see it, but I don't know. And one of the guys in the documentary made that point. He's like, I built this stuff, but I still feel, caught up in it. If I'm actively engaging with it, it's still an addiction for him. So you have to find these times to really, I think, detox from it in many ways. Yep.
There's another thing that's tied to this, and I can't remember who, it might have been Chris Dixon, but I can't but it was really thoughtful. You make money from either unbundling or bundling.
Right.
And so centralization or decentralization.
Yeah.
And it goes in, and when I think about that, it goes in waves throughout time.
Yes, yes.
And why? Because so the internet itself was supposed to be the great decentralization.
Yeah.
Right. So everyone had a choice.
Yeah.
And what ended up happening? We centralized power faster.
Yes. Yeah.
And why? So it sounds okay. Well, we shouldn't have done that. Let's go back to decentralization, which a lot of people on blockchain and everything else right now is happening, and it will happen in currency, like we're talking about Bitcoin and the works. But why? And let's leave Bitcoin out of, because once that's done, I think it will stay decentralized.
Yeah.
But let's talk about some of the other things. Why does that happen? And it happens because we compromise, human beings compromise. Decentralization is too hard for us to, we don't want to go to every single place to make a decision.
Right.
We want something that Google says, here's the place to go. We need something to simplify all of our decision-making process so that we can get through the complexity.
Yeah. And this is the same reason we trust experts, right? It's like, we can't be an expert in every domain. So I need to, you know, read your book, be like, hey, this guy studied it. I like what he says. I need to trust that you've done the work. Exactly. I don't have the time to do.
Sort of. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So I think that's a great point. And yeah, those waves of centralization and decentralization, seems like Bitcoin could be kind of the base layer to a re-decentralization of the internet, where people start to own their own data, at least in theory right now. It doesn't exist in practice, but there's projects like Urbit that's very interesting in this space. And if that happens, if people then that are today, say, using Facebook for free, largely unknowingly that they're the product, I think they're just giving up their free data. If they are now given an incentive, which would be, hey, you can, instead of giving that data away for free, you can own that data and monetize it through whatever channels may come available, that could actually break those data monopolies like Facebook and Twitter, et cetera.
So once they're that big, it's really difficult, because there's others that would do that today.
Yeah.
And why they don't gain any traction is, once you've aggregated supply, like I said, the algorithm is so good. It provides so much value to you that you can't unlock a whole bunch of supply fast enough to be able to break that network effect.
So you don't think that, my hypothesis here is that perhaps the monetary incentives of the individual user owning their own data or monetizing their own data could become a force significant enough to break network effects?
Maybe, but probably. So I don't think you think about that.
Yeah.
When you're going to make that choice, and right. That's the thing. Like it sounds good in theory.
Yeah.
But doing that and saying, okay, Robert, here you can monetize your network, and you could make against the network right now, where our scale of our network right now, you get privacy, but you can make one penny a week. Or one penny a month.
Yeah. So yeah, there's got to be some tipping point in that.
There has to be some tipping, exactly. And that tipping point could be either I massively fund it and break that through, but you have to create so much value for the new supply to change from one place to another.
And you'd have to go narrow, right? First.
Exactly.
Punch through.
I'll tell you an area that I'm that kind of with government that I'm talking about this right now. Health will look exactly the same as the other monopolies, with a winner take all in health that will do everything, and you'll trust it because the algorithm will give you better health. Unless governments start getting their act together with going privacy first, and then you own your health data.
Right.
But it's exactly, we're just really early in that cycle. Yeah. But what do you think Amazon, Google, everything else, why did Google buy Fitbit? Is for the same reason.
Yeah, yeah.
And as you're aggregating that data and you aggregate more and more data sets, AI can see outcomes that you can't see.
Yeah. So is privacy right. then the fulcrum? Privacy,
privacy for health, I believe, becomes a fulcrum.
Wow.
But if it doesn't happen fast enough, then there's going to be too much value in the network and privacy will do this. It's exactly the same thing here.
Yeah, it's gravitational almost, right?
It's because the outcomes are so much better. That's actually why you use them. The outcomes, you're making a choice without realizing you're making a choice because the outcomes are so good.
Right. To your earlier point about, actually we discussed before the show about network effects. It's not increasing the number of network participants that's the value. It's the connections between the participants growing exponentially relative to the number of participants that draws people in. There's just so much more value being generated by the network.
And by the way, that's a super important point for a whole bunch of the altcoins today and everything else. And I'm not saying some won't work. I'm not saying anything like that. But to say they all have network effects is not true. A network effect has to add more value to each participant in the network from what the system is doing. Mm-hmm. And if it doesn't, I equate a lot of what's happening in altcoins today to eyeballs in the internet in 2000, just before the .com crash,
right,
where everybody was chasing eyeballs. And eyeballs, because Amazon had lots of eyeballs and on a network effect, eyeballs became super valuable.
Yeah.
And a whole bunch of people bought more eyeballs. More visitors, and it had no value back into the network.
Right.
And so all of those went to, how many went to zero at the time out of the same thing? So when I look at the, and again, I want to be careful because there will be value created in some of the different altcoins. But when I look at all of that, all of what's going on there, most are not. Most are not creating more value at the network for all users.
Yeah, no, that's a great analogy. And it seems like that is the path that will go, just that most of them will at best be testnet for Bitcoin.
And then what ends up happening is the winning network, and that's what it builds layer two, builds layer three, builds everything to it. Just like Amazon went from books to everything else, yeah. and then became web services for everything else, and selling their back end as a service. So it went from business to business to business to business from a narrow offering.
Right, and I think too that a lot of this. Actually, my hypothesis is that there will be absolute consolidation at the base layer. I think Bitcoin will kind of be the base money to this whole, you want to call it a distributed consensus network or whatever. Whereas more of the experimentation will occur at higher layers, maybe even on top of Lightning Network or RGB, these other things. But it seems like, you know, in terms of gaining maximal survivability, immutability, censorship resistance, you need to anchor into the Bitcoin blockchain. And that is the ultimate winner take all market. It's almost like, everyone wants to be on the most survivable chain. So of course everyone wants to build the thing on top of Bitcoin. Now it may depend on the use case too. If it doesn't need censorship resistance as much, then maybe they can go build it on Ethereum or some other less secure network, but there's a trade-off there. You're giving up survivability.
And the trade-off today on Ethereum, I just don't know what the use case is on Ethereum still. The trade off, because it's too expensive to use as a back end to do this work right now. So I just don't. It's not a world computer, which it's set out to be.
Agreed.
And when you think about going back to Bitcoin, where even today multisig, and I think you've already explored this as well, but when you think about even multisig, how that changes contract law.
Yeah.
Like these are staggering advantages. So why do we, when you, when you, when you think about why I make an agreement with somebody else, and on that agreement, who gets paid what, and what if they don't fulfill?
Yeah.
You could solve that with multisig.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a great piece written on this called, it was written by Parabolic Trav and a co-author whose name escapes me, called Bitcoin Contract Governance. And it gives you some inkling as to just how disruptive Bitcoin could be outside the sphere of money. We're talking about using multisig to run a parallel contract system that lives outside of the courts, that in many use cases where the conditions are relatively objective is more effective and much cheaper than reliance on the courts.
Right.
So, it gets super interesting when you get down that rabbit hole. I had one last question on this PICNUF. I love that framework you laid out there. So using these tools, digital tools, we're opening a little window where an outside enterprise, let's say, can influence our thoughts pretty heavily, especially if we're engaging with the technology every day.
Like really heavily.
Yeah. So for me, it's Twitter. Maybe for you as well. It's like I have a lot of screen time with Twitter. Whatever advertisement they decide to point at me, they're getting a lot of attack surface, you could say.
Yeah.
So, and this gets to the thing that I tweeted about you this morning, I think was your words to live by tweet that you put up, where there's the classic quote that, careful of your thoughts become your words become your habits become your character. And that's what it is. Like, it starts with your thoughts that crystallize into your being over time. So you have to be very careful with the raw materials, your thoughts. And this is where I think it's really important that people actually sit down and consciously develop a life philosophy. It's, you are in many ways sort of software engineering yourself. And if you don't take the time to sit down and do that, you know, as you do your words that you recite every morning and night, and I want to ask you about what else you do. If you don't do that, then you're opening yourself up to be programmed by other interest, I guess you could say.
Right.
So,
and you still will be. So if you just take propaganda, or if you take any brand that you believe is a really great brand, and you say, why do I believe that? Is it because you know for sure that that brand has better value than something else, or is it because you believe that that's true because you it's always been true. It's just the rate that happens today in technology is so staggering. We have to watch, because we're so addicted to it. We have to watch for misinformation coming in and back to that error correction. Right. One of the things that, to kind of stepping back from the fray and going to first principles, asking, why do I believe this? Why is this true? Why is this true? Is that true? Can bring down your beliefs to the things you know for sure are true.
Yeah.
And then you can build on top of that. And it provides better ways to, when you go to a life philosophy, to be able to play in a game that's moving so fast, it's hard for our brains to comprehend.
Yeah, right.
And we believe it's happening to everybody else, but we're immune to it, and it's happening to us too. Right. So you'll notice on Twitter a lot of times when I don't say you, I say we.
Mm.
So we're fooled, not because. I have to suspect if I see something in everybody else, a natural condition in everybody else.
Yeah.
I used before the example of the exponential pattern that nobody gets.
Yeah.
I conclude me in that, right? Because if you see something, if you see something, a condition in everybody else that nobody else seems to get, it's in you too.
Yes.
So how do you do things to be able to break those down? And so that 10 questions that you tweeted out today.
Yeah.
And so all of those. So I ask myself that each night, and I have for 32 years, my kids have it, my friends have it. And what I've found is through ups, downs and everything else that keeps me, by the way, I'm not saying let's use one. Am I putting thought into action? I'm not saying I'm always perfect at it.
Right.
But it's making me better at it all the time.
Right.
Right. It's a, and so it's not a way to measure, oh, I'm bad at this. Am I staying in balance? I haven't always been perfect at it, but by asking myself the question in my subconscious, it forces me to come to a conclusion. Okay. That's important to watch.
Yeah.
And so you get better at those things.
That's wonderful. You actually encouraged me to be a little more exacting about it. Do and write a lot, but I want to get more, I guess, habitual.
And connected to this, Robert, and I know this doesn't seem so much like a Bitcoin podcast, but connected to us, but our learning is actually the most important thing we have today.
Yes.
Your curiosity and your learning is actually the thing that will allow you to see patterns that nobody else sees, to be able to take advantage and to design the life you want. It's the most important thing. So how I look at myself is I'm 100% responsible for every single thing around me, mm-hmm. everything.
Mm-hmm.
And well, sometimes it might be someone else's fault or I got hurt or something else. Mm-hmm. If I blame somebody else, then I can't find the learning in me.
Yeah.
And so, because I choose my time, I choose all my time, I choose what I do. So I have to be responsible for everything else.
Yeah.
And that sounds, so it drives it, and there I can learn from everybody wherever, because I'm learning faster as a result.
Yeah.
That would seem diametrically opposed to what I'm about to say, but it is not. In the same thing I do there for myself, I don't expect everybody else to have the same thing.
Right.
And I don't need them to.
Yeah.
I have, because I'm not trying to do it to be better. I'm trying to do it to be better for me.
Yeah.
For the people around me. I'm not trying to do it as an ego to somebody else. I'm trying to improve my rate of learning.
Yeah.
So when I look at everybody else, I don't expect them to do that or anything else. I have empathy for where other people might be in their life. Yeah. When I say empathy, I don't mean sympathy. I mean empathy. I really try to understand what in your life led you to that conclusion, the way that you see the world, the way you see it.
Mm.
It doesn't mean I agree with them at all, but if I understand that, I can build better connection and I can build better and sometimes better learning to me.
Yeah.
Deep Thoughts, Jack Handy. Did you ever, empathy
yeah.
is about walking a mile in someone else's shoes. That's that way you're a mile away from them when you don't agree with them and you have their shoes. but it really is about that empathy. If you understand and then you don't take all this, the stuff that's kind of coming at you and everything else too seriously.
Yeah.
It's their thing.
Right.
But you understand it.
Right. No, I love that. There's a movement back towards responsibility, which is something Jordan Peterson is really big on. And we could say the blame someone else is kind of an abdication of that responsibility, because it is you choosing right. who you interact with, how you spend your time, et cetera, et cetera. Right. And I love you actually, that's reflected in your language when you're using we instead of you or I. You're using a language that's more conducive to productive dialogue. And we could say that, all of this we're talking about, by the way, this getting down to the ideas and learning and error correction, like it's all rooted in the logos and in the classic concept of it. And that's what we should be aiming for, is better dialogue with one another, which is dialogos, like the coming right. together of logos between two people. And all of that takes us back to this really important point in your book, I think, is that it is hard to think differently, though. We, with central planning, it almost interrupts the dialogue in the marketplace or among market participants. And it seems like, we're in this economic dogma of growth is always good, right? We just have to optimize for growth. But to create that growth, we're creating debt, right? It's where the central bank is actually creating more and more debt in the world, trying to stimulate the economy into more and more growth. but it's having a diminished return. I think the we touched on yesterday was, I forgot the number, 50 billion in new debt, or 50 trillion.
185 trillion over the last 20 years of new debt.
To create $40 trillion. To produce
$46 trillion of economic growth.
Right. And once that's below 1-to-1, it's sort of self-defeating because that debt is constraining future growth.
Right.
So we're just sinking, but putting on the weights faster in a way.
But connected to what you just asked, it's hard to think differently. Yeah. That's the, our brains to be able to ask that question and think different. We're taught a certain set of circumstances and we don't want to dig. It takes too much power to takes too much curiosity to it's to be able to go deeper and think differently. Mm-hmm. It's easier to trust the experts. It's easier to trust somebody else. You assume somebody else has already done this work and they know better.
Yeah.
And what ends up happening, and I see this all the time. And remember, we're in a phase transition.
Yes.
And the beginner's mind has an advantage in the because they don't have the same expectations of knowledge. But what you're seeing is, I read here's a book that was written in the 1930s when technology didn't move as fast as it moves today, and why gold will always be there, or this or this, and people are like over and over and over going back to different frameworks for a different time.
Yes,
and they're so stuck into, okay, that's the framework, and trying to fit the pieces together. And they're going back to experts and you hear the same worn out things over and over and over again, all based on what you just said. We believe that we can grow forever.
Right.
The very idea of growth is the thing that's breaking down, because growth in an information system is just like it is an error correction. It means information is free.
Right.
Today, look at the information exploding. Information is free. Growth in an information system becomes free, and more of our world is going into an information system.
Right. So
therefore, more and more of our world should be going into massive negative growth, but productivity.
Productivity boom.
Yeah. So productivity boom, but as it taking away growth and freeing our time. But it's going the other way, because we have such a hard time with that concept. Our growth mindset means, okay, we need higher paying jobs, we need more jobs, we need more things, more everything else. And even though it's sitting right in front of us, all around us, we can measure it in the things we're using every day. They're becoming free.
Yeah.
We don't see it. Because it's so hard to think differently, and so this is actually what makes entrepreneurs so crazy or radical at the start, because they see something that no one else sees and they build to it.
Right.
Steve Jobs, the crazy ones, right?
Yeah.
Celebrating the crazy ones, and. This is actually the big idea in the book, right? The big idea in the book is, this is a totally different world that we're moving into that people aren't seeing. But the pushback against the existing system is it can't understand this.
Yeah.
And back to the same experts that cause the pain because they can't see it, that are now defending that and everything else and looking for, you can understand why these things happen so violently or why they become so challenging.
Yeah. No, that's so interesting. So this is just coming to mind. I don't know if maybe I'm not on a limb here, but maybe this is another way to think about it, is that we had growth in, I guess you could say, spatial growth in the 20th century. We're trying to actually turn raw materials into more stuff to expand and build out civilization. But when you reach a saturation point there, that you become more of an informational society. So you look to stop growing in terms of space so much, but more growth in terms of time. So it's a temporal growth, which is productivity. You just do creating more output with less or the same inputs of time. And is that what it is? Is it like we got hung up on the word growth. It's like we're moving from one growth to another.
So think about most people that are listening this to today, especially in the US. We build houses, little houses, for the things that we can't store in our big houses.
Yeah.
And we put it, yeah. And we have rows of little houses that have storage that we never go and look at our things that we buy, yeah, for that they sit there for years. And there's a whole business around the little houses that we store our stuff for our big houses, more, yeah, and more things forever. That we need more and more. And it's exactly what you just said. But the things that are changing is information is free.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And information is this Zoom call. It's free.
Yeah.
We don't need to fly on a plane to do this call anymore. And the Zoom call with it, what this will look like in a couple of years.
Yeah.
It will feel totally different.
Yeah.
It'll feel like we're in the same room.
And because information is free, the quantity of information has absolutely exploded.
It explodes. And that's what ends up happening. In that information, you would expect to see, as the information explodes, a whole bunch of really bad ideas.
Yes.
A whole bunch of nonsense.
Yeah.
You'd expect to see, but you would also expect to see error correction faster.
Yes. Yeah. So right. So the
things that those ideas that cut through the clutter and go, oh, that is something I need to think about. You pick up and it drives a whole bunch of change. And so that's really what's happening. And it's just starting.
That's where, and I think this ties back into humility, right? Because you're, the world is changing so fast for you to think that your mental model is equipped, like it's fully baked, right? It's all you'll ever need.
Yeah,
that
totally.
Arrogance is so self-defeating. So the new appropriate mental model is like maximal humility. Like you're
maximum humility allows you to see what that you need to see. That's exactly
right.
Exactly to learn.
Yeah. Yeah. There's two quotes in your book that I loved on this. It was, argue as if you were right, but listen as if you were wrong.
Right.
Which I think is just tremendous, right? Then the second one, which is connected, strong opinions weakly held.
Yeah. And I got that from Bob Sutton and those are those are really great frameworks to use today. In fact, in Twitter, some of my favorite people do that. They're constant. Wait, right. That is a piece. And by the way, they're not, when they see a piece like that, that actually adds to knowledge and advances that, and not just for Bitcoin, but for any knowledge, they're not afraid of their ego. They celebrate the other author. Even if that other author has 10 views or
right.
10 followers,
yeah,
they celebrate celebrate that instead of saying it's all me, right? Those type of people in an ecosystem actually build an ecosystem.
Right. Yeah, I love that about Bitcoin Twitter, is that it really does, it's very idea meritocratic. It doesn't matter if you've got 2 followers or 200,000, if you're putting good quality content out there, it gets to the surface. I mean, relatively
really fast. Yeah, really fast.
So so interesting. And it's like humility is increasingly valuable the faster change is occurring, because we're naturally less able to deal with it, right? We're back to that human inability to comprehend exponential change amid the greatest technology boom of all time.
And go back to just think about this from any power. What do you think about somebody who has a whole bunch of wealth or power and flaunts it? Just what do you personally think about that person?
Just poor character.
So I think about, and this is, I better read my questions so I don't, but I used to think, are you kidding? Like, how dare you act like that? I want to knock you off that pedestal so fast. That's what I would have. We want to attack somebody that looks like that,
right?
Because it feels so it feels so wrong. Like it feels so like so when you have humility, you learn faster. You're more open and everything else. And by doing that, you also build a larger kind of probably bit, maybe a longer time span to be able I just if I think about my personal thing about, or anybody that kind of steps into arrogance,
right?
I have a natural aversion to that.
Yes, agreed. It's and it seems like that was more common. Again, it's this, we're what is the old quote, where the tools we make in turn make us, in a way, where humility may have not been as useful in the 20th century when things weren't moving as fast, because it wasn't as much new information to adapt to. Right. And maybe that's why we had, it was sort of characterized by dictators and a lot of bureaucratic arrogance and things like that. But by a result of this technological shift underway, it actually shifts the character traits that become competitively competent in the new model.
I love what you just said. I love what you just said. That's exactly, I think that the character traits that become more valuable in an economic system because they learn faster.
Yes.
It is that. And one of those is that humility, so you can learn faster.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing.
Like if you think about what we're trying to learn against, we're trying to learn against supercomputers that are learning at a rate that the standard isn't you or I trying to learn against each other. The standard is to learn at that rate. What are you doing every day to learn at that rate?
Right.
Like, what are you doing? And it's really important.
Yeah.
What are the things holding you back from seeing what you need to see? The kind of those questions that I said, what are those? What are the things that keep on happening to you in your life that you think it's everybody else, but it's really you?
Right.
What are the different areas of focus that you should be curious about and learn deeper? But how do you invite a whole bunch of people around you that hold both you accountable, you hold them accountable to that learning and humility?
And in doing so, become better than you could on your own, right? Just
right.
For people to reflect your blind spots or weaknesses back to you is just immensely important. I think so. The other thing I liked about you went into, so we're in this technology boom, as we've definitely covered. One of the examples I really liked that you went into in your book were the case of autonomous vehicles. So yep. Most Americans at least own an automobile. It sits idle 95% of the time, which is crazy. It's like to think that you own this asset outright. It's a very, typically the second most expensive asset for most people next to their home. And it sits idle. You don't even use it 95% of its, useful life. And how the implications of digital technology by being able to automate driving, the second order effects that has on the city and parking area, urban design even. I thought that was a great example of, it's more than just, although the information technology is what drives the change, it's reshaping physical reality as well.
Yeah. So if you take that example and just say, and it forces you ask the different question, right? So self-driving cars. So I don't need one day I won't need a steering wheel in my car. I won't need it just drive. In other words, and some people might choose that. Eventually everybody will choose it because it'll be safer and everything else. And insurance rates on the existing would go through the roof because human error is the biggest source of accidents, insurance claims, everything else. Yep. And that, so you can, when you go through the list of what we think now, why we buy now versus what it would look like in the future against self-driving, everything changes. And so why do you own a car? And a lot of people will tell themselves when I ask that question, I own a car because I like to drive. Mm-hmm. I own a car because I want this and I love this. And by the way, I might answer the same thing because I grew up in a different system. Mm-hmm. But why I really want a car is for convenience. I want a car the minute I want it, and I want it whenever I want it. So for as long as I want it, I want it for convenience. And I don't just want one car. We need two for our family, and I have a 57 bus, 1957 bus, but that's a long story. but because we won't both want convenience, and 95% of the time it sits in the driveway. So you need two parking spots, two car garage, everything else. If we're both, downtown, there needs to be two parking spots downtown for our cars. The entire system has to be designed around that. Well, it sits idle 95% of the time. And so the capacity utilization on a car is 5%. And with self-driving cars, it'll change that capacity utilization, probably not up to 100%, but up to 50% or 60%, where if as long as I have a car when I need it, I won't buy a car, I'll use the network.
Yeah.
And so my car, whether I buy a car and then I lease it back, or then I rent it back to the network so it can go out and pick up other people instead of being idle, and it can drive them around instead of being idle, it changes everything. It explodes all of the parking in cities. And if you think about how much parking is in cities that expands into either park space or residential space, it changes so many different variables just out of that one change. And people typically look at, I know they look at this, because if you look at the forecasts of car manufacturers over the next 5 years and look at the number of cars they have forecasted that they're going to sell, and mm-hmm. it's upwards on a hockey stick, not a hockey stick, but upward trajectory, because they all believe that there's going to be more and more cars sold, because there always has been more and more cars sold.
Yeah.
But if 5% utilization rate goes to 50% utilization rate, then there's going to be way less cars sold. And all of that collapses. And it turns into an entirely different model. It looks like a software as a service model.
Yeah.
The aggregate supply and the aggregation of supply on a network creates more choice for buyer. More, I have a car whenever I want it. I don't have to wait 3 minutes. I only have to wait 30 seconds. With more supply, and I get choice of whatever car I want instead of one car, and it looks exactly like a networked platform. Right. So that's in the future of this industry, and it changes so many different things about the automotive industry. Looks completely different, as do many other industries as a result of it.
Yeah, I got this from Mises and Human Action, actually. It's like, we don't value physical goods. Humans don't care about actual physical goods. It's always about the services they render. So we can say that all goods are services. You have a plot of land. It's not the plot of land. It's whatever you're doing with the land. It's the service it's rendering to you. It's hunting ground, or it's leisure ground, whatever it may be. And for cars, you know, it's clearly transportation is the primary service. It's also status for a lot of people. You know, it's the kind of, it's an avatar for themselves, if you will. If you drive whatever a nice car, may represent that you're rich, or where you are in the socioeconomic hierarchy, or it could even be a statement of values. You know, a lot of people drive the Prius in California to be like rah-rah environmentalists, or maybe you drive a Tesla. So what does the other thing from Mises I got was, the job of the entrepreneur, as to your point earlier, is to fit the world to its future, anticipated future data structure. So what does the world actually look like from a data standpoint in the future, and how can I bridge the gap between where we are today to where I think it's going to be? And that's the bet and risk you're taking to try and create a profit by solving problems for people in that new world. The one thing that comes to mind is the by eliminating, to your point in the book, we eliminate parking space in the city, so we've increased economic density. What else do you think? Like, how else does this impact the world?
We eliminate insurance.
Mm.
We're just talking about, so we eliminate a whole bunch of cars from the road, from production. So production falls. Mm-hmm. We eliminate insurance. We eliminate parking in the cities, and a bunch of that. As well as that change is happening, Zoom and conferencing and everything else is changing in a different order. Where, wait, I don't even need to be in the city as often.
Yeah, right.
I can move somewhere totally different at a way lower cost of money and make and change my. So there's so many changes right now. It's actually why I'm my day job is not what we're doing. It's building these types of companies and working with entrepreneurs that are doing this, and it is so wild. It's so much fun. Yeah. Because you're actually you're creating kind of where these things are going. You're at the front of edge of it, and it's just it's a wild ride, but it changes so that part of and for entrepreneurs out there and how much opportunity there is in this change is staggering. It is staggering because just about every industry comes down to what you just said about Mises is actually true. And what's happening is, here's an example. We in a business, you always used to have to have a server, mm-hmm. because you needed a server.
Yeah.
And then Amazon and AWS and Microsoft changed that. You rent server space. And so you have the need, and it provides the need in a different way, and it reduces the cost of access. But that same thing is what we think we need, the physical good,
yeah,
to provide in the automotive example of, so I'm overpaying for a car that sits idle 5%, 95% of the time, mm-hmm. for convenience.
Yeah.
And if you solve convenience in a different way, you have a totally radically different business.
Right. It's interesting. And so is it the sharing economy? Is that like we're moving more into just by, I guess, because I assume in the autonomous driving world, car ownership would probably collapse as well. Like, why would you own a car when you could just rent whatever you needed? Whatever, maybe you'd still own. Maybe some people still own one, but
if you owned, what you would likely do, or if you want to make money on it, okay, I'm not. It's not in use right now. Rent it back to the fleet and make money on it.
Rent it back to the fleet. Yeah. So, is that the big theme here? Is that we're gonna move more into a sharing economy by, I guess, increasing the utilization rate of assets. We'll move more
less things, more things have become digitized,
more utilization per thing. Yeah, interesting. And it's so funny because I the comparison I drew in my mind there with Bitcoin is like, okay, autonomous vehicles eliminating all this idle parking space, which is like, I think the number was 30% of LA is parking, right?
Yeah,
maybe it's 20%, I'm not sure, but. So you eliminate all that idle asset effectively, and then you could put commercial asset there in its place. So you'd increase the economic density of the city.
Just do what you just said. Look at what's happened right now. And it's just a sign of things to come with Zoom and the commercial asset of the city.
Right.
Right. So does it need all that space?
Do we need the economic density in the
city? We need all that space. Yeah. And all the restaurants in the space are actually designed around, there's a whole bunch of people downtown at a certain time.
Yeah, that's right.
And all the other services around the from dry cleaning to everything else is around the same function.
Right.
So those changes, those structural changes change so many other things.